Welcome. I'm Hannah Baba, filling in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Right now, there are over 426 labels and logos in 246 countries representing some kind of ecological or ethical or sustainable attribute, according to the Eco Label Index. Some food labels have pages and pages of regulation behind them, like the label USDA Organic, while others, like the label All Natural, have next to nothing governing what they mean. Some are recognizable, like non-GMO project verified or fair trade, dolphin safe or gluten free. Others are more obscure, like shade grown, rainforest certified alliance, or bird friendly. But as the number of these eco labels increases, people may be left confused and overwhelmed by the string of symbols circling their food product. And more companies are seeking out the certifications to be seen as sustainable businesses. But what exactly do these labels actually promise? Well, consumers might not always get what they expect when purchasing a certified product. For example, certain non-organic or synthetic materials can be used in up to 5% of a USDA organic product and in up to 30% of a made with organic product. Fairtrade USA requires only 20% fair trade contents in the product to use a front panel label with no requirement to list this low percentage. Many eco labels have done a great deal to raise awareness, to change what we expect from certain product categories, and to create a common framework around sustainability. Their usage grew by 41% in the year 2012, according to the State of Sustainability Initiatives Review. Studies have also shown that consumers are willing to pay more for certified products. So, how do we keep these labels trustworthy without potentially letting businesses exploit people's goodwill? Joining us to discuss all things food labels today is Kirsten Lindgren, campaign coordinator for the Fair World Project, a campaign of the Organic Consumers Association. The Fair World Project works to protect the use of the term fair trade in the marketplace and educate consumers about key issues in trade and agriculture. She joins us from Boston. Welcome, Kirsten.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us is Urvashi Rangan, Director of Consumer Safety and Sustainability at Consumer Reports. She created a database of eco-labels on greenerchoices.org, which provides expert evaluations for labels on food, wood, personal care products, and household cleaners. She advocates for credible labeling in the marketplace, including influencing government policy decisions at the state and federal level. She joins us from the Consumer Report studio in New York. Welcome to the show, Urvashi.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Thank you. And we welcome you to chime in at any time during the show. Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Urvashi, let's start with the question, you know, what's the importance of a credible label in relation to creating demand for better production systems?
Yeah, sure. I mean, credible labels are just so important to the marketplace. It's really in a mass market like this where you don't know exactly how your food or your product is produced. Credible labels are really the way to know that and to have assurances and guarantees that standards have been met, that something's been verified to meet a set of standards. And for us, independent credible labels are even better. And that really gives the highest level of assurance to people that something that claims to do something, in fact, actually does it.
And so that there's this trust factor there. I trust that this label is really promising what I expect it to deliver.
Yeah, that's right.
And how easy is it for companies to actually create a label or get certified by an existing label?
Yeah, it's actually you know, the world of marketing is kind of interesting. Companies have lots of options out there. They can actually seek out a credible certifying label group, and there are those out there, and Animal Welfare Approved is a great example. Even organic has 600 pages of standards behind it and has to be verified, whereas compared to the natural label, which pretty much anyone can decide to put on any product for almost any reason, has no standards and no verification on most products and very little on meat products. And yet what's really interesting is that about a third of consumers confuse natural for organic. And what that highlights to us is the sort of unlevel playing field that's in the marketplace, where companies have lots of options, maybe too many options when it comes to making marketing claims, and we feel like there's no floor to the whole thing. And as a result, there's a lot of green noise in the marketplace. There's a lot of ability to cloud things and make claims that sound like credible label claims that aren't. And it's really hard for a consumer to tell by looking at a claim on a product or a claim with a logo around it, whether it's meaningful or not. And so we spend a lot of time going through those labels, trying to help people understand those. And it's also why we spend a lot of time at the government level trying to ensure that there are better policies in place so consumers can not do so much guesswork.
So let's start with that distinction between organic versus natural. What does it mean for a product to be labeled organic?
Rep from Organic Consumers Association can talk about that as well. I mean, organic means a lot of things, actually, and it took 12 years for those standards to get developed. And while they're not perfect, and we actually spend a lot of our time watchdogging that label, there is a government program behind it. The USDA runs the organic label. When you see an organic claim on food, it really does have to mean something, and there are three different tiers of organic labeling. But something that's 100% organic or 95% organic, which would have the USDA seal on it, means that most of what is in there has to come from things that were produced organically, and that means without synthetic fertilizers, without a number of synthetic pesticides or toxic industrial pesticides. Animal byproducts are not allowed to be fed to animals. That's the causative vector with mad cow disease, for example. Antibiotics are not allowed to be used in the raising of animals, although there is a loophole in poultry that we actually have been wanting to get fixed in organic. Sewage sludge, for example, is prohibited to be used as a fertilizer. Those are examples of the types of standards that are required in organic. There's no genetic modification that's allowed. And there are composting standards, for example, how long you actually need to compost manure for before you can use it organically. Lots and lots of standards, and it means someone had to inspect that farm or inspect the producer annually in order for them to get a certification.
So that sounds like it's not really easy to get that organic label.
Oh, no, it's not easy, and it's a lot of work and a lot of paperwork in order to get that.
So now let's go to natural, then. What's natural?
What is natural? That's a great question, and we don't exactly know the answer to that. We know there's a lot of lawsuits that have brought that into question. Can a product contain genetically modified organisms and be called natural? Apparently, yes. Can it contain artificial ingredients and be called natural? Yes, at times it can. And there are very few standards for what it has to mean at the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, who really deals with mostly, I guess, processed and packaged foods, if you want to think about that in terms of the natural label. It's really just about artificial color. And we've even found artificial color in products labeled as natural. It really doesn't have to mean very much at all, and it doesn't have to mean anything. And it doesn't have to be verified, and there's no paperwork required. It's really unfortunate, and frankly, groups like ours think that that label does such a disservice in the marketplace. And if we don't want to define it at the government level, let's not. You know, let's ban it, actually, so we can allow the credible labels to actually compete.
Who issues the all-natural label, then?
The manufacturers can decide to put it on themselves. If it's a meat product, anything you put on meat has to sort of, have to let the USDA know, the Food Safety Inspection Service. But their definition of natural is just that no artificial ingredient is added to the cut of meat itself. It has nothing to do with how the animal was raised or what it ate. So you can have an animal that was physically altered, had its beak clipped or its tail docked, was confined, never saw the light of day, ate drugs every day, ate animal byproducts, and lots of other sort of unsavory things we allow in animal feed. And you can call that product natural if you want to. It's just about the cut of meat itself. It has nothing to do with how the animal was raised. And it, survey after survey we've done, it falls seriously short of what consumers expect from that label.
And certain non-organic or synthetic materials can be used in up to 5% of a USDA organic product and in up to 30% of a made with organic product. Can you break that down and why that's okay?
I can break it down. There's three tiers of organic labeling. There's the 100% organic claim, which will tell you that everything in that thing had to be produced organically. When you just see the word organic or you just see USDA organic seal, which is what you often see, it means at least 95% of that product had to be organic. There is a 5% non-organic allowance in that, and whether you agree with it or not, the reason they have that is to allow for things like minerals that can't be produced organically. Unfortunately, the allowance part of that got widened in the mid-2000s after a lawsuit, which sort of opened the door for more artificial ingredients to be used in organic. And let's talk about that for a second. Organic in the regulations has a provision built in where artificial ingredients can be reviewed and approved by a board and recommended to the secretary to be put on what's called a national list. And it's really mainly used to allow for certain artificial ingredients. A number of groups like ours
what?
Have said,
sorry.
Okay.
Arvashi?
Yes.
Like what? Like what artificial ingredients are okay?
There's quite a number of synthetic ingredients that have been allowed in organic production for certain things. I can pull up the national list while we're on the line and give you some examples. But baking powder is one, and that's sort of one of the more benign examples. But, you know, people try to push the envelope on that and try to get some serious synthetic ingredients approved. Now, they don't all get approved. But it is that list that is allowable in that 5% portion. There's a wider list that's allowable for the 30% portion. But what's important, I think, to note in that, you couldn't do probably a lot of the processed organic foods without that allowance. Some people will say maybe we shouldn't have the organic label on processed foods, and that's one way of looking at it. Other people may feel like, no, I guess I want some allowance. But here's how we see it. Those ingredients should be listed for a 5-year period, and then they're supposed to sunset. And there's actually some funny footwork going on at the government level saying that actually, maybe we'll keep those things on in perpetuity. So if we don't feel like sunsetting them, they can just stay on in perpetuity. Mm. I can tell you that we and a number of groups, including the Organic Consumers Association and the National Organic Coalition, are fighting that. And the fight will be coming up here at the beginning of May in San Antonio, Texas, where one of two public meetings that happens around the organic label every year will happen, and the public is free to make comment and participate. And that's another big advantage of the organic label. It has that transparency. We know what's going on, and we can watchdog that claim in a very public way. And in that way, there are a lot of advantages to it, while there are also many places it can be improved.
Right. Kirsten Lindgren, let's talk about free trade and fair trade as a label. What is considered fair trade?
So fair trade, unlike organic, is a little bit more focused on social justice. And so fair trade does have some environmental sustainability criteria also, like organic, but it falls short of organic. But where fair trade picks up is on a lot of the social indicators and the social side. And so if we're talking about fair trade, it generally means that farmers are paid a fair price for what they produce. We're usually talking about countries in the global south, although domestically the concept is picking up now also. So organic guarantees a lot of things, but it doesn't guarantee that the farmers are actually paid the cost of production. And fair trade attempts to pick up there and make sure that farmers are actually paid for the work that they're doing in a way that allows them to continue to produce sustainably and take care of their families. If there's workers on the farm, it guarantees things like freedom of association. It attempts to get to a living wage, which is a little bit trickier, but something that definitely we're pushing to see. And that farm workers are able to work with dignity and have a good job that also allows them to take care of their families. And so all of those more social justice side of labeling. And as you said before, the problem what we see in fair trade, similar to organic, is you can have a pretty small percentage of ingredients in a multi-ingredient product that is actually fits that criteria for fair trade and still use the label in a lot of cases.
And the label is issued by whom?
The biggest labeler in the U.S. is Fair Trade USA, but they're not the only, for a while they were the only labeler, but now we are seeing emerging markets. So we have Fair Trade America, which is tied into the international system, has the international fair trade market, which is the same that you'd also see in Europe. And then we also have Fair for Life, which is another European label, which actually does do a little bit of a better job at looking at the whole product and the whole picture. And it's Fair for Life, Fair Trade, and that's a label that people may have seen on Equal Exchange, which is one of the pioneers of fair trade coffee, and also Dr. Bronner's Magic Soap have used that Fair for Life logo, which is a little bit less recognizable in this market, but really coming into its own also.
And which do you think, if you're ranking all these fair trade labels, which would be on the top, and which one are you really monitoring?
Yeah, well, and we're monitoring them all because it is such a much trickier subject. And but if I had to rank them, I would probably say that in terms of labeling and what is most clear to a consumer, Fair for Life requires at least 50% of product ingredients in the product to be certified. And they've also do a pretty good job with workers' rights and farmers negotiating for a fair price. So they are probably the best if I really had to rank them. The Fair Trade international symbol is has some strength also in that the farmer producer groups around the world are really behind that mark. That was kind of the original pioneer mark, and they have recently opened up their General Assembly to allow for farmers to have 50% of the say in their General Assembly. So if we're talking about what farmers being the center of these labels, then that is the place where they really have a voice more than the other label. And then Fair Trade USA, we are actually, my organization, Fair World Project, right now doesn't recognize them as a credible label for a couple of reasons, and in part because, for example, their apparel standards, so they've gotten involved in fair trade apparel, and but they don't require the cotton fibers in a fair trade apparel piece to be certified. They can they would allow the symbol to be used if only the final stage in this very complicated production stream, the final factory, is looked at. And they don't really have the expertise to be looking at a factory as a traditionally agriculturally focused certifier. And so in their factory standards, they don't even have some very basic freedom of association, democratic organization of the factory required in their standards. So there's
and
a
like,
couple places that
for
we
example,
feel that they're really, sorry?
In chocolate, it's interesting. In chocolate products, they only require that a single specific ingredient be certified, like the cocoa, but other ingredients like the sugar don't have to be in fair trade form.
Yes. Yep. And that's the other problem. And yeah. And so what we I think was talked about a little bit at the beginning of this show is one of the problems is, as Arvashi said, that from green noise, I really like that. And so not only, you know, can a company come in and maybe choose a certification that they can easily meet, some of these companies will come in and say, I'm going to get just the chocolate in just this one chocolate bar and not the sugar and not the chocolate in any of the other chocolate bars, and I'm going to slap this label on this one product, and I'm going to highlight this to prove that I'm a great company. And that's a lot of the problem that we're seeing, not just, so it's not just if you look at the one product that's the problem, but it's the ability that companies have to use their one product that they happen to have certified to put maybe a halo over their whole company.
All right. I'd like to invite our listeners in on our conversation. Chime in with a question or comment at 866-798-TALK. Do you look at food labels when you go to the store, when you go to the shop? Do you care? Do you look at them? Do you read them? And do they influence what you buy or how much you buy of it? And how many food labels do you actually recognize at the store? 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have a caller. Let's go to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Welcome to Your Call.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I was wondering, and I'm coming in late to the show, you may have discussed it. I was under the impression, I pay a lot of attention to labeling, that labels of fair trade and on coffee is pretty strictly regulated. You can rest assured that the environment is regulated well and that the workers are well treated for harvesting the coffee beans. My question is related to that. How accurate and how stringent are the labels on eggs being cage-free or free-range or any of those other things? Is there any regulatory going on so that the egg producers are checked to see if the, you know, the hens really have free-range or whether they're getting cramped into quarters where they can't move?
Okay, thanks for the call, Ruthann. Arvashi, well, she mentioned coffee. We actually want to talk about that a little bit later, about kind of assuming that my coffee, because it has free trade on it, you know, is what it claims to be. But let's try to answer Ruthann's question in terms of free range eggs and how reliable that is. Arvashi Rangan?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. I could not really hear Ruthann, so just for your technical people,
well,
but let me answer free range on eggs, which, again, is kind of like natural, has very little meaning. You know, when you see that on a meat product, and we think eggs are like that, FDA regulates eggs and USDA regulates the chicken, so it gets a little split, and sometimes we don't know what labels actually are falling through the cracks, and pardon all the puns there. But free range basically means that that chicken had the option to go outdoors. It didn't necessarily go outdoors. Cage-free, which is kind of similar, although it has more definition, it means it's not in a cage. For eggs, that has meaning. For a broiler chicken, it doesn't, because broiler chickens tend not to be raised in battery cages anyway, but it can be cage-free and remain indoors its whole life and be standing, you know, in a very filthy sort of house crammed in with other birds, and you can still label the thing cage-free. And like I say, free-range, the birds pretty much didn't have to see the sun on their backs in order to be labeled free-range. I'll also even go further to say organic's got some work to do when it comes to poultry and free-range. Even organic poultry standards are not specific enough, and there was a lot of work done actually on the access to pasture for other animals, and that got a lot closer to being sort of fixed and having definition, and so livestock like cows and sheep and other things actually get access to pasture. The poultry bird is supposed to have access to the outdoors and organic, but we know that screened-in porches seem to count.
So, Arvashi, can you hang on to that thought? We will continue the discussion. We just need a break. You're listening to Your Call. Food labels, do you look at them? Do they influence your buying habits at all? 866-798-TALK. We'll be right back after a break.
lots of ways you can take part in today's conversation on Your Call. On the phone, it's 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. And then at noon today, This American Life with Ira Glass.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we're talking about America's favorite drug. Okay, it's caffeine. We'll talk with Murray Carpenter about his new book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. How prevalent is caffeine in our daily lives, and how is it affecting our minds and our bodies? That's tomorrow. And Friday is our Friday Media Roundtable, where we discuss the week's news coverage and speak with journalists on work they're doing. But today we're talking about food and food labeling. Food certifications and these eco labels you see at the store when you go to the store and do your shopping. It's easy to find foods with a string of certifiers on them. There's organic, there's fair trade, there's GMO free, there's natural. But what do these labels actually mean when you go to the store and you pick up that package or whatever you're buying? Do you really care about the labeling? And if you do, how does that influence what you buy? The number to call to chime in and join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Joining us are Urvashi Rangan, Director of Consumer Safety and Sustainability at Consumer Reports, and Kirsten Lindgren, Campaign Coordinator for the Fair World Project. So here's a question that comes from a listener. Are there any labels that people have asked you about in terms of, you know, they're wondering what these labels actually mean? What are kind of the number one, number two, number three labels that you've been asked about, Urvashi, in your work, where people are kind of like, what does this mean?
Well, I always feel like, you know, in the 15 years I've been doing this work, every year I can go on with a box of egg labels, and it's news every year. Someone will want to cover it. So that includes lots of the labels we've already talked about today, natural and free range. There's a couple other ones that are kind of misleading too, like no nitrates. I always like to tell people, because I got duped by this myself until I started looking into this, which is it doesn't necessarily mean no nitrates. It could mean natural nitrating agents were used, like celery powder or onion powder, which essentially do the same chemistry. They cure the meat. So when you see something that's labeled uncured, no nitrates or nitrites added, look at the ingredient list. And this isn't the fault of the companies in this case. This isn't the company deciding to mislead or deceive consumers. It's actually an arcane regulation at the USDA, again, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who's regulating meat labels, which tells producers if you're using a natural nitrating agent, you must label it uncured, no nitrates added. And we think that's simply wrong and misleading, and it's another good tip for consumers to know. One other quick one, hormone or no hormones added.
Yes.
Meaningful on a lot of things, like milk, like beef. Not that meaningful on poultry. They are legally prohibited from receiving hormones, so are pork. So those are good little tips for consumers to have.
It's like the chips that have no fat on them. Let's go to a caller, Greg in Palo Alto. Greg, welcome to Your Call.
Hello. Hopefully, turn my radio down. Sorry.
It's okay.
There were several things that I was concerned about. One is, I think if you're a wise customer, you not only read labels. I'm not even sure you can trust what's on the labels. I think that you, if you really wanted to check it out, and I've done this, I've called up some of the companies that sell products, and maybe this is, shouldn't be done, but at Whole Foods, and often you get really gibberish from a number of these companies with regard to what they mean by organic, what they mean by natural. You'd almost have to go to the location to find out whether or not it's legitimate. The other thing that I had to say was you can get an organic product, and it can be packaged in plastic. Now some of the companies are putting BPA-free on their canned products, but I have shopped for a long time at this one retailer, and I can't find an organic ketchup in a glass bottle. So it's everything seems to be going to plastic containers, and I think that's as serious a problem, if not more so, than the organic issue, because of the leakage of things like BPA, et cetera, phthalates into the food. So, you know, you really have to be an incredibly wise consumer, and you're going to have to spend time, you know, really investigating whether or not you can rely on the labeling.
Well, thank you for that call, Greg. Kirsten, let me ask you what Greg is asking about packaging. Is packaging at all considered when labeling fair trade or organic or any of these labels? Is it just the actual product, or is the packaging involved?
Yeah, it is a great question and a great point. And I think that what that points to is that we really do have a problem in labeling, as we do in a lot of other areas of siloing and not really looking holistically. So, yeah, for fair trade, one of the issues that's really coming up again and again is the new K-cup rage. So you can get fair trade coffee in a completely disposable K-cup, and there's about 50 K-cups to a pound of coffee, and they all end up in a landfill. But the problem is in that, you know, completely unsustainable, and then the farmer's just getting, you know, about a nickel on the dollar for coffee because it's so expensive to buy coffee that way. But there are a lot of people who don't want fair trade to address that because there's so many issues with just getting the coffee off the farm into the country, and, you know, that just takes so much effort that it's really hard to get people to think, okay, now we have to think about sustainable packaging. And there are lots of fair trade roasters who will use a compostable bag of coffee or offer a reusable K-cup and are doing lots of really cool sustainability initiatives, but it's usually considered above and beyond fair trade. And there's a lot of resistance from certifiers and labelers to consider some of these other issues that are really key to the core values that a lot of us who advocate for a more just economy hold. There's just a lot of pushback of saying, no, but that's not really our area. We're focused on the farm.
All right. Ruth Ann earlier talked about coffee. Can we talk about these company-created certifications? Like Starbucks says that 86% of their coffee is certified, but under their standard called Coffee and Farmer Equity, C-A-F-E. So that's like their own fair trade standard, but it's the company itself. Is that common?
Right. Yeah, it's increasingly common, and not just in coffee, but other areas too, that the standard that's collectively agreed upon that usually has some pretty key stakeholder involvement. So for fair trade, the farmers themselves have had a say in it. I mean, it doesn't work for Starbucks, so they go and create their own standard. And usually how it happens is they create it and then they will hire somebody else to verify that they're reaching their own standard. But yeah, it's still a problem that they're not getting wide input onto what should go in that standard. And although they're not calling it fair trade, it again is very confusing to consumers, especially when they're saying 86%, or I think I've even heard them say 95%, as high as 95% more recently, of our coffee is certified, and that includes fair trade. But then you read the fine print and find out that only 8% of it is fair trade in their own cafe practices that you referenced. don't talk at all about what Starbucks is paying the farmers. It's only requirements for the farms themselves to implement, and those are pretty weak. Also, perhaps a bit better than conventional coffee production, but not by much. There's a lot left out of them. And again, no requirements for Starbucks themselves either. So yeah, it's confusing, and it's definitely a problem.
And there was a study at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology at Harvard and London School of Economics. They found they could boost bulk coffee sales by 10% by just adding that fair trade label on the packages. And so, you know, has going mainstream strained the integrity of the well-intentioned labels, do you think, Urvashi?
Well, I guess I just want to zoom out even from that question to say, you know, any individual label is probably not everything we might hope it would be. And that doesn't mean there are labels that are that aren't misleading people. There are, and when you only have something that's 1% fair trade, that is misleading. Kind of picking up on the packaging question, you know, those are good questions, and it's something that certainly for some consumers, if it's wrapped up in plastic and organic, it doesn't make any sense. But just for people to understand that legally, that's not a requirement. Where we get especially bunged up is where there is a legal requirement, say for poultry to have access to the outdoors, but there's absolutely no teeth behind that. And in that case, they're not living up to what they even claim to do. And I think those are important differences. I think where things fall short in terms of what we hope they would be, we as consumers have to be vigilant about what we want. And labels and certifiers and even companies using their own labels need to keep up with that. And the meaning of these things needs to move up over time. A label shouldn't stay static in meaning over time. What is sustainable? How we get there? It's an ideal. It's a continuum. It's something we learn more and more about. And as we learn more about it, we need to be integrating that understanding into these actual standards so that they move up over time. And our hope as an organization at Consumer Reports is that these labels are the pioneers in creating more sustainable and healthy food systems and bringing the bottom up. And we've seen that happen. We've actually seen the bottom move up in things like even antibiotic use in agriculture and farming. It's finally getting the acknowledgement and the concern that it deserves at the governmental level. It may not be moving as fast as we want it to, but the acknowledgement is there, and we are starting to see things move. McDonald's wants their eggs from chickens that can spread their wings. Well, we'd like the chickens to be able to do more than that, but that's an important step forward, and it actually makes a difference. So consumer demand matters. Companies respond to that, and this is a dynamic landscape, and we should all expect it to improve over time.
In relation to antibiotics, which you just mentioned, we have a comment from a listener, John, who's asking, with all these antibiotics that are fed to farm animals, does that affect what label they can get? Kirsten or Urvashi, who wants to take that? Urvashi?
Sure. It does affect what label they can get. You know, one might ask, if an animal gets antibiotics, should that product actually be labeled as received antibiotics? I mean, wouldn't it just be easier if we could actually disclose what goes into animal feed on a daily basis, for example, and if they're eating antibiotics every day? Unfortunately, the way it works here is if you don't use antibiotics, then you need to go through your USDA clearance. So antibiotics typically apply to animal production. You might be surprised to know that certain fruit trees can be treated with antibiotics as well, apples, pears, peaches, nectarines for fire blight, which is a big problem. But overall, we as an organization are against the use of antibiotics in agriculture because of the public health concerns around resistance. So quickly, the label claims no antibiotics ever used. If you see that on meat, while it doesn't have to be inspected to be verified, that's the downside of that claim. The standard USDA holds and will enforce to is it can't have ever gotten it.
Okay.
In the case of organic, when it comes to poultry, unfortunately, that chick can receive antibiotics up to the first day of life. We want that loophole closed. And the more USDA hears from people like your listeners, the more they'll start paying attention to that, too.
Great.
So
let's go to
organic is less.
Excellent. Let's go to our callers. We have many of you waiting on the line. The number to join the conversation is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Do you care when you go to the store and you see these food labels? Do they influence your buying habits? And which ones do you really care about? You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Liz in Oakland. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm calling to ask if organic label means something is non-GMO, and I've been frustrated not to be able to buy cornmeal that's organic. A lot of times in the bulk areas, something might be labeled organic, but it doesn't label what country it's from, and I don't want to buy any food from Asia, so especially from China, and so I'm kind of frustrated with this process.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Kirsten, you want to take that on?
Yeah, so the first, or Rashi, feel free to jump in because I think this is a little bit more your area, but organic does mean not GMO. I think there's another part of that question, too, and then just to jump back in to the fair trade, which is more my area of expertise.
Sure.
Also, fair trade also means non-GMO for the ingredients that are certified themselves. So looking at fair trade, which might not help with the cornmeal aspect so much, but if you see something that is fair trade and that would apply to a single ingredient product or the ingredients that are labeled. So, for example, with sugar, that could be key because so much of our sugar supply is beet sugar, which is also GMO. So if you see fair trade sugar, you would know that it's not GMO also.
Irvashi?
I think it's important for people to know, though, that there's one label out there called the non-GMO verified label, and they're actually testing. And that's an important distinction because I think it does give an even additional level of assurance. Fair trade and organic, both are, it's a process-driven point, and so the paperwork has to be there, and the inspection on the paperwork is there. We actually think organic ought to have some kind of threshold and test to it overall. As far as country of origin, there are country of origin labeling guidelines, and people should pay attention to those because the loopholes exist when things go into bulk or things are repackaged here. Then you can futz around with the country of origin labeling. When you buy things that are pre-packed in the countries that they're from especially, they have to be labeled as to their country of origin in most cases, and whether that's trade laws or country of origin labeling laws, that does apply there. You should talk to your store about it and tell them that you want to know, and if it's a store that cares about something like that, maybe they'll start doing it.
Alyssa in Palo Alto, welcome to your call. You're next.
Hi. Well, I'm a pretty label conscious and health conscious consumer, but I have a question about, and it's not about the nutrition per se, it's about the location that foods come from. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So this morning, for instance, I bought an overly labeled like coconut crisp snack, and it's got every certification on it, and it says handmade by, and then it says the company. But it doesn't say where it's from, like where it comes from. Now, there's a telephone number on it, and from the area code, I could tell that it must be pretty local. I prefer to buy local if I can. But sometimes these things will just say, like, distributed by. And that's, like, where the distributor is, and you don't know where the food comes from. So you have to go to the computer or whip out your phone and put in the brand name, and you have to sometimes really search to find out where your food is coming from. Which is kind of related to the woman who didn't want to get something from China. But is there any requirement about listing the source, the location of where your food comes from?
Okay, Irvashi Rangan, lots of questions today about location.
Sure, yeah, no, and it's an important thing. People want to know where their food's produced. You know, in order to make choices to buy that or not to buy that, and I think it's really a right-to-know kind of issue. Again, this comes down to when you process food here, there's lots of loopholes in country of origin labeling. where if I buy peas and carrots from overseas and bring them here and I cook them and I package them up into something, I can actually label it made in the USA. And we have a big problem with that because obviously the thing didn't grow here in the United States. It grew somewhere else. And this has played out a little bit in ground meat, for example, which can be, say, an animal born in Mexico, raised in the United States, slaughtered in Mexico. And country of origin labeling actually now makes the label put all that information on there. Canada and Mexico actually filed contention at the World Trade Organization over that as a trade barrier issue. So people outside of the United States at times don't want us to have that kind of multiple country of origin labeling. Ingredients individually are not required to have origin labeling, and like I say, there are loopholes to the origin labeling that almost allow for a completely deceiving label to be put on, and these are all problems that actually need to be fixed and addressed by our government that mans the country of origin labeling laws.
And that's Urvashi Rangan, Director of Consumer Safety and Sustainability at Consumer Reports. Let's continue taking your calls. Let's go to Kevin in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, I was hoping that your guests could comment on the fact that we seem to be making a transition historically from physical labels to digital labeling, where you can shoot the barcode of a product and get all sorts of information about the product and the company. You got Good Guide, Open Label, other efforts to expand the capacity so that people don't have to memorize what does this insignia mean, what does this insignia mean, but they can just go to some web-based information that would be more in-depth.
All right. Thanks for the call. Kirsten, are we getting closer to whipping out our iPhones and scanning a barcode that tells us everything we want to know?
God, I hope so.
I think that's definitely is a trend, and there's a lot of good resources out there. Then the next issue becomes, I think there's two issues really with that. As we have more and more information, it can be used to maybe mask some very basic information. It can lead to some information overload. We have to, if you look at, the caller mentioned the Good Guide, which I think is a pretty decent resource, but you want to evaluate who is providing you this information, because different organizations have different criteria that they're judging labels by also, or where they're getting their information from, and is it just publicly available information that may or may not be accurate also. So I think that in some ways that trend is really good, but there is still an extent to which a lot of consumers want and need just that sound bite of, is this okay to buy or is this not okay to buy? And they don't want to have to weed through all that information and determine what the source is also. So, I think we still do really need to have that sound bite snapshot on the product, credible label set up also, in addition to the more information that we're able to feed people using technology.
Right. We're here in Silicon Valley in San Francisco. Who knows, a tech guy in his office right now might be listening and think up an app for us. Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Josh, who is in Oakland. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I had a question regarding the more strict stipulations on labeling. For instance, you mentioned with chocolate, the sugar is not required to be fair trade. My question is regarding, as a company who's trying to utilize fair trade stuff, if we restrict that labeling so that if they do use unfair trade sugar, they wouldn't be able to use the fair trade labeling, would that discourage companies from actually going to fair trade at all at that point if there's no real benefit, if they can't get all of their product and become more cost prohibitive? How is that being addressed, or do you think that that would end up being an issue if we do restrict labeling more?
Okay, thanks for the call, Josh. Kirsten, so he's asking about the example we gave earlier in terms of one ingredient needs to be fair trade, the others don't, and will that discourage companies from even going fair trade at all?
Right, and I think that is the argument used. So all of these certifiers of Fair Trade USA is actually the only one who has so far dropped the policy that all the ingredients have to be certified, if any of the, all the available ingredients need to be certified. Fair Trade America's international network, Fair Trade International, has a separate program used in Europe now that allows for that, but here in the United States, they're not allowing that. And Fair for Life does not allow it. So we're really talking primarily about Fair Trade USA right now, and also Rainforest Alliance, which is not Fair Trade, but is another eco-social label that's often grouped in with Fair Trade, too, because they do some pretty similar things. And Rainforest Alliance allows for this, too. And that's the argument that Rainforest Alliance and Fair Trade USA make, is we want to have any benefit is good. It's a step along the way. And I think that's, you know, maybe a philosophical difference. So I think that my organization would say, you know, it's not okay to start getting that market advantage. And we talked about how that's what it really comes down to for a company, that if they want to use the label because they're going to sell more things. There should be some threshold where, sure, they can start buying that fair trade cocoa if that's what they can first buy, but there should be a threshold of commitment that they reach before they can put that label on a package and start getting increased sales because of it. If they want to put it in their annual report that they're moving in this direction, or, you know, discuss it in some other ways that they're making progress to a goal and they're helping some farmers and increasing their own sustainability, and there's other ways of communicating that. If they have a very small commitment, but to be using something that's going to increase their sales, or that's going to communicate something to consumers, it should mean something. And we've heard from consumers that it is confusing if there's a very small percentage in a product and there's a label on it. It's confusing, and people expect and want that whole thing to be certified and be fair trade or be ethical in some way. And when it's not, they feel disappointed and angry that they feel they've been deceived. And I think if in a company, same with a company, if they're making a very small commitment in one product line, it's really confusing to consumers. So sure, you know, of course you have to start someplace, but before that label is used, there needs to be some credibility in terms of commitment and communication.
And that's Kirsten Lindgren. Thank you so much. Also, Urvashi Rangan was on the show with us today on Your Call. Thank you if you have called in, and if we didn't get to you, we are sorry. I'm Hannah Baba, and this has been Your Call.
What do we know about caffeine? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Murray Carpenter on his new book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Caffeine is the largest, least regulated, and least understood drug trade in the U.S. Most people don't know how much caffeine they consume or where it comes from. How does caffeine affect our bodies and minds, and should it be regulated? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.